welcome, everybody. I am Rachel DeGolia, Executive Director, Universal Healthcare Action Network, and proud NPA board member. I'd like to just acknowledge we have folks from a number of states in our call tonight. This is truly a national call. These are medical students, faculty, and practicing physicians. As far as we know, we have folks from Connecticut, D.C., Florida, Massachusetts, Maryland, Maine, North Carolina, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Washington, Alabama, Georgia, and Michigan, and probably a few others I haven't mentioned that have decided to join us at the last minute. So welcome, everybody. Just by way of a little background, this conflict-free leadership call is hosted by the National Physicians Alliance as part of its Unbranded Doctor Project, which takes place under the Partnership to Advance Conflict-Free Medical Education Grant, which we call PACME. The PACME grant is the result of a state attorney general settlement regarding the inappropriate marketing of the drug Neurontin. Partners for the grant include, in addition to NPA, the American Medical Student Association, Community Catalyst, and the Pew Charitable Trust. And I believe we have staff for all these organizations on the call. And the goal of this project is to reduce conflicts of interest created by the pharmaceutical industry in the medical profession and in medical research. Well, the partners on this grant promote a number of approaches to raise awareness of the issue and to build leadership in the medical profession to eventually eliminate some conflicts. I guess we can't claim we're going to eliminate all of them, But we're making progress, and as the call tonight will show. So for more information about this project, you can visit the NPA Unbranded Doctor website at npalliance.org/conflict-free. So tonight we are very happy to be talking about a concrete win, which has been part of the Affordable Care Act, which is now going into effect. And our speaker tonight is Wells Wilkinson, who is director of the Prescription Access Litigation Project and staff attorney with the Community Catalyst up in Boston. The way we're going to do this is Wells will speak for about 15 minutes or so, and then for the balance of the call, we're going to have Q&A. So given how many folks we have on the call tonight, we invite you at any time while Wells is speaking to email your questions as they occur to you to Ann Wollison, NPA's Education Director. And Ann will make sure that we either ask them during the call or that you receive a response following the call if we run out of time. That seems to work better than to have people speaking up when we have so many on the call. Ann's email is, and I will announce this once again later, ann.wollison@npalliance.net. So the call tonight is aptly titled Let the Sunshine In, and I really wanted to insert an audio at this point from the Fifth Dimension singing that song, but I didn't get it together on time. So let's just imagine that we're Let the Sunshine, and that's what we're going to be about tonight. At long last, the final rules requiring public disclosure of pharmaceutical company payments to doctors have been issued under the Physician Payment Sunshine Act. And we're going to hear more, we're going to hear about that from Wells. But first, I would like to introduce Ann Wollison, Education Director of MPA, to say a few words. Ann?
Thanks, Rachel. That's great. And thanks, everybody, for joining us tonight. It sounds like somebody else just came on.
And thank you to me for not singing the whole song, right?
Well, we've got to record it now, so who knows when it's going to show up. Anyway, so I'm pleased to say that this is the seventh of in a series of bi-monthly leadership calls hosted by the National Physicians Alliance as part of this partnership that Rachel just described. NPA offers a number of educational opportunities through this project, including these calls, national grand rounds, and other resources that are available on its website. And I encourage you to visit the website and listen to the national grand rounds and to these calls. Wells was featured on one a couple of months ago where we talked in detail about drug settlements, for example, and how such settlements might be opportunities to perhaps fund for example, prescriber education programs in states. I would encourage you to listen to that call and other calls that are archived on NPA's website. Really quickly, it's npalliance.org/conflict-free. And if you go to NPA's homepage, there's a place right on the homepage where that conflict-free link is available. And I just also really quickly wanted to mention that our next National Grand Rounds will be taking place on April 9th at Georgetown University at the hospital there at noon. And the focus of that National Grand Rounds will be the release and also the updating of the EMSA Farm Free Scorecard. And I think it'll be very exciting because the information will be brand spanking new and newly released. So I encourage you to look for an invitation to participate in that national webcast. And I think I'll stop there. And if you have other questions about the project or about this talk, Rachel has provided you with my email address, which she'll provide again later on in the call. And I'm going to stop there and thank Wells for joining us tonight. He is also, my understanding, going to invite Marcia Hams to talk a little bit about the history of the Champagne Sunshine Act. So I'll stop there and let Wells take it from there.
Great. Thank you, Rachel and Ann, and thank you, NPA, for inviting me to speak about the Physician Payment Sunshine Act. I work with Community Catalyst, and we're a national consumer healthcare organization that's working with about community-based local and statewide organizations in about 40 different states. And I've also worked on the Physician Payment Sunshine Act, kind of lobbying and advocating for the best possible policies for the last, about three and a half years or so. And we were very pleased about a month ago when CMS released the long overdue final rules to create what they're calling the National Physician Payment Transparency Program. And this new initiative, we think, will open a much needed window into, the nature of the hundreds of thousands of financial and other transactions between our drug and device manufacturers and the physicians who prescribe them. So I wanted to introduce my colleague Marcia Hams, who's the Director of Prescription Access and Quality at Community Catalyst. She was the lead organizer on our efforts to pass the Physician Payment Sunshine Act since we started that work back in 2007. Marcia?
Hi, thanks a lot, Wells. I just want to give you a little thumbnail of some of the history of the work that led to the Sunshine Act, and many of you were involved in that as well. And we started the prescription project at Community Catalyst in 2007 with funding from Pew Charitable Trust, and we were concerned about the ways in which the high cost of drugs was undermining access to health care generally, and we're working with a group in New York around the issue of professionalism, medical professionalism, and the ways in which the industry was influencing medical professionals. And so we came together and Pew funded this effort, and we focused in on changing state policy around conflicts of interest and gifts and other aspects of improving quality of care and reducing the influence of the industry, and began to work on the Sunshine Act, which had been filed initially in 2007 by Senators Grassley and Cole, and then became part of the ACA. One of the things that had been happening and that we worked hard to expand was efforts at the state level, beginning with Minnesota, which had passed the gift ban and disclosure law in 93. Vermont joined them in 2002, and Maine, Virginia, West Virginia, Massachusetts, D.C., eventually Connecticut, have all passed either disclosure laws or some bans on certain kinds of payments. All of that activity really began to create some pressure for a national solution because the industry was not happy about the prospect of having to address 50 different systems for disclosure. And so that did help to gain some support from industry for the final passage. And as you know, the bill actually became part of the overall ACA proposal and was passed along with the with that bill. So that's basically the history. And along with that work, we also were working with medical schools and academic medical centers on their own internal policies, which also were focused on conflict of interest. So I'll turn it back to Wells.
Thank you, Marcia. So, you know, one other thing we learned, aside from the useful pressure that all the different state disclosure programs had created, was that the Department of Justice had been kind of actively investigating probably five out of the six large manufacturers in the country and had found that there were many different forms of payments and other kinds of kickbacks that were occurring. And in the process of those investigations and then the prosecutions and settlements that followed, one of the requirements was that these manufacturers would have to report all their future payments to physicians and sometimes other healthcare providers on public websites. And so there's a certain amount of public disclosure going on anyway, and I think that really kind of helped ensure that you know, the Pharma Trade Association wasn't going to really stand in the way of a federal or a national disclosure or transparency program starting. And that was, I think that was very helpful. So in terms of, you know, the law passing, it was included in the healthcare reform law that passed on March 24th of 2010, and we're happy to see soon after that the program landed in the offices of CMS, because we thought this would help the agencies that oversee Medicare and Medicaid better kind of integrate information about drug utilization and the patterns of payments that they might be seeing to physicians. And so that would kind of, we hoped, help them be a little better able to look for patterns and possibly do investigations and alert the public about things that might see. Now, we know that CMS had a lot to do after the passage of the Affordable Care Act, and they unfortunately missed their first deadline in October of 2011, about a year and a half later, to finalize the procedures to implement the transparency program. They did issue some rules about 2 months after that, and they issued a draft rule, and it was a very, very long document. To their credit, it was very, very transparent about the kinds of decisions the agency was going to make in implementing the Sunshine Program. But after that process was concluded and public comments were taken, we still waited almost a year for CMS to issue the final rules. And as a result of that, this transparency program is not starting in January 1 of 2012 like we had hoped, but it's going to start on August 1st of this year. So a little more than a year and a half late. But, you know, here's in a nutshell what's going to happen. On August 1st, the program will require manufacturers of drugs or devices or biologics to report nearly all payments or any other kind of transfer of value that's made to any physician or any teaching hospital. And these payments will have to be described in some detail, you know, specifically the amount, the date of the payment, the name of the recipient, physician or teaching hospital and their address, and then other descriptions about the payment itself, like whether it's a cash payment or a cash equivalent, like a check, whether it's in kind, like you might see if they were someone that receives a meal or a ticket to a sporting event or travel, etc. And then there'll be some description of what the payment is for, if it's consulting, if it's a gift, if it's a meal or travel, if it's for education or research or a grant, or if it's compensation for speaking in a continuing medical education program. And it will also have to describe if that payment's related to any specific drug or more than one drug, and they'll have to name the drug products themselves. And I think that's going to be very important as well. Now, in terms of penalties, if the manufacturer fails to report a payment, they could pay between $1,000 and $10,000 for each failure, and that's capped at $150,000. Those are for kind of innocent or inadvertent mistakes, but if they intentionally fail to report a payment, then they could be fined between $10,000 and $100,000 per failure to report. Unfortunately, there is a $1 million cap on each year, etc. So, you know, I should be clear at this point that there's no reporting requirement under the law for doctors, nor can doctors be penalized under the law. These reporting requirements and penalties apply only to the manufacturers. So this detailed data that is going to be reported by the industry to CMS will become public on a CMS website for the first time in September 30th of 2014, but then every year after it should be made public on June 30th every year. And so we think this is a huge victory. It's going to be a great opportunity at long last for patients and the public and healthcare programs and the medical profession itself to be able to track and evaluate payments by industry to physicians and teaching hospitals. Now, the mechanics of the reporting will be that, you know, every year on March 31st, industry will have to report all their payments from the prior calendar year, and then physicians will get a 45-day window, actually, to review the information and to submit corrections. And there'll be a process of 15 days where there'll be some dispute resolution going on, et cetera. Now I can talk a little bit more about, you know, how disputes will be treated if people are interested. But in terms of the, you know, kind of overall program, we did get a number of successes in the rulemaking process. CMS did do a number of things that tried to, you know, we think, kind of narrow some loopholes that existed in the statute. And so we're happy about that. You know, one thing that they did was that they require any payment that's made in a kind of an aggregate or a lump sum form, like a check from Pfizer for $10,000. If $8,000 of that is for research and $2,000 is for travel, then CMS has said you have to report that in its divisible parts. And so you can't kind of lump a number of other things together in the most benign kind of label and call something research when, you know, when it's really not for that, exclusively for that purpose. So that was a good thing that CMS did. They also did a number of other things, like there's a loophole that allowed delayed public disclosure of the information if the payments relate to research on either new medical products or new uses of existing products. And, you know, they worked hard, I think, to kind of narrow that exception to only apply to products that aren't approved, or kind of a more narrow class of payments for clinical investigations of drugs or devices that are already on the market. So those were some kind of victories. Now, we didn't actually get a number of other things we wanted to see in the final rule. And one, this relates to the, you know, what I call the third-party marketing loophole that was in the statute. And that basically says that a manufacturer has to report the name of a doctor that receives the money unless they make the payment via a third party and the manufacturer does not know the name of the actual physician who receives the money. And so this is going to allow, for instance, industry to fund CME as long as they do it through a third-party institution and they don't know the names of the physicians who actually are going to receive the financial support for the CME activity. And so that means they can't identify which physician should get this money. So that's actually, you know, a plus. We were hoping that the rulemaking might go a little further and somehow be used to require them to name the physician to receive this kind of this support. So we're still looking over the final rule to see, you know, what some of the other things in it, what they're going to mean. But I think this could be, in a small way, something like the situation I heard about the Stark Law, which prescribes doctors from kind of profiting from self-referrals to testing centers and other things like that that they own. You know, I heard that in the rulemaking process around that, it created whole industries. And it's because of the authority that the rulemaking agencies had and the way the practice was at the time. And I think given the amount of money, the tens of billions of dollars that the drug industry spends on marketing to physicians, I do suspect that we could see something similar. We could see, you know, maybe on a smaller scale, but we could see medical education committees and other third-party entities either getting more and more money from industry or kind of new entities popping up. And so it's something that I think we should all kind of watch out for and try to do our best to monitor. But overall, we're looking forward to working with patients to help them better understand what these payments are and what they could represent. And we're also looking forward to working with other stakeholders like students and doctors to help them understand and use this data in meaningful ways and to help maximize the promise that this powerful tool of transparency might have to improve patient care and medical professionalism. So I would like to, at this point, answer any questions, and more importantly, I'd love to discuss the potential impacts that this broad transparency, could have, and how will doctors and medical students be interested in using this information themselves, for instance.
So let me just repeat the email for people to submit questions. Send it to Ann Wollison at ann.wollison, W-O-L-O-S-O-N, at ntalliance.net. And I'd just like to ask a first question while people are emailing Ann Wells. How do we find out when they haven't reported a gift?
How do we find out when a manufacturer has not reported a gift?
Right. What are the main ways that information gets discovered?
So I would say, based on past practices, the main way that most malfeasance by the drug industry is discovered is through disgruntled employees, whistleblowers who basically get in touch with an attorney and try to file a legal action that exposes what's going on. That's oftentimes what happens. So that certainly could occur in these cases as well. Usually whistleblowers bring cases when they have evidence of widespread fraud that's cost the federal government a lot of money paying for a particular drug product. So we may not see a whole lot of whistleblowing if it's only going to lead to small penalties. But we could see any physician or other healthcare provider had knowledge or awareness about this, there probably could be a mechanism for them to report this kind of information.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Anne, you got some questions?
Yeah, I have a couple here. One is, are samples included as something that needs to be reported?
Good question. So, samples are not included under the Physician Payment Sunshine Act. There is a separate provision that actually requires the reporting of samples to CMS or to HHS, and I'm not exactly aware of what the status of that rulemaking process is. And it's unclear, though, whether that information about samples being distributed to doctors and hospitals will be made public. That's one area that's not entirely clear. But right now, samples are excluded. A number of educational materials, as long as they're intended for patient use, would be excluded. So, one example was an anatomical model, and other items that are used with a patient would be excluded. But something like a textbook or something like that that's used by the physician would actually be reported.
Hmm.
And one other actually big exclusion is kind of de minimis payments below $10. So things like, small items like a notepad or a pen or even a small meal, like a bagel or something, would not be reported and unless these unless they amount to more than an aggregate of $100 or so in the course of a year, then they would have to be reported.
Okay. I have a couple more. Should I just keep going?
Yeah, please.
Okay. Wells mentioned something about organizations who are provided funding from the industry that some of that money may go to a speaker, and this is around conferences where someone may act as a keynote and receive money from the conference host, which actually came from a drug company, and it sounds like that is not reported. Is that correct?
Well, no. You'll actually have to. The industry will have to report payments to physicians if they speak if they speak, if it's kind of payment for being a faculty on a kind of a speaking event. I believe there's one exception, and that might be an exclusion for continuing medical education events that are ACCME accredited and for which the and for which the manufacturer doesn't pick the speaker. I believe in that case they don't have to report them. But in other cases, like if a person is part of a speaker's bureau and they're paid by a drug manufacturer, then the manufacturer will have to report those payments. So I believe there's some protection if it's an ACCME accredited event, then those payments may not have to be reported. But outside of that situation, if it's a conference of various kinds, then manufacturer would have to report.
Okay, Ann, got another?
Yes, I have several here.
Okay, good.
And this is kind of subjective, but is $1 million cap a year sufficient? Is that cap for any given doctor or the total damage faced by the company? Is it just part of the cost of doing business?
Yeah, it's a great question. So it doesn't relate to the physician. It actually relates to the drug manufacturer. So, you know, they could be penalized, let's just say, a maximum of $100,000 for knowingly failing to report a payment or transfer value. And that could happen 10 times in a given year, but then after the 10th time, there are no more penalties. So under the civil penalties under this law, you know, then that might be a $1 million fine. There is somewhat of a weakness, I think. But that doesn't mean that these are the only legal means that the federal government would have to enforce this law. And so, for instance, it might be possible that if a drug manufacturer is intentionally misrepresenting these payments, they might fall under another statute like the false statement statute, which penalizes people who lie to the government. And in that case, there may be a way to bring criminal sanctions against people in the drug manufacturer corporation who are responsible for the intentional failure to report.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but that's interesting. That's good.
Yeah.
Will doctors have any recourse if they feel that the report about them is incorrect?
Sure. So actually, that's something I just looked at because I know I was going to be speaking to physicians, and I thought it might be something of kind of great interest. And you know, after these payments are reported to CMS, CMS is going to create a portal for physicians in teaching hospitals to then access and see the information about just themselves. So a doctor could look up what payments have been reported that they were to have received in the prior year. And you know, after that, doctors have a way to file with CMS a dispute over whether this payment information is accurate. And physicians will have 45 days to kind of preview the information, and then an additional 15 days of dispute resolution time for CMS and the manufacturer and the doctor to kind of figure out, you know, what is the accurate reporting. And even if the dispute's not resolved by then, the CMS website's going to be able to actually present both sets of information, the amount that the manufacturer reported, and then also the amount that the physician stated was received, and the fact that there's a dispute. And so I think that's going to be kind of some protection for physicians who feel like the reporting is inaccurate. There'll be a public display that they've disagreed with the information the manufacturer has submitted. So.
How have other medical groups reacted to the Sunshine Act? Any supportive that you're aware of?
Oh, that's a good question. I did review some of the comments made by a number of other entities, and I also looked through the the actual rule. And in the rule, CMS talks about and describes a number of the comments that they received. And you know, they actually received, I thought, a lot of comments by people who hadn't really kind of read the statute, and so they're asking CMS to do things that they clearly didn't have the authority to do, like, you know, to include nurses in payments to nurses in the Sunshine regime, and also to kind of exclude doctors for all sorts of reasons that you know are just not allowed, et cetera. So I think there were a number of different comments from kind of different sectors. Yeah, I do think that CMS did a really good job of trying to implement the most comprehensive program that they could, given the statute that they had. And even when they had discretion to include or exclude things, I think they did a rather good job of erring on the side of including payments and making fuller public disclosure, which I think is helpful for consumers and you know, advocates like us.
Well, let me just add one thing, Wells, to that, Ms. Marcia, and that is that we have, in our discussions with medical school leaders and academic medical center leaders on their own internal conflict of interest policies, and we've been working with them to improve them along with NTA and the other members of PACME. A number of them see this as a means, the leaders in teaching hospitals, as a means to be able to audit the disclosures that their faculty make to them as institutions. And so they're seeing, some of them are quite supportive of it as a way to do that and to continue to move the ball down the court on the issues around conflicts of interest. So I think that those many leaders in those institutions have been supportive.
This next question is a good follow-up to that. How do you think the residency exception will interact with the requirements for reporting gifts to teaching hospitals?
Well, let me just, I'll explain the residency exception first, and then I'm not sure I can speculate on how they relate, but the definition of physician under the law includes doctors of medicine or osteopathy, dentists, podiatrists, optometrists, chiropractors, and who are legally authorized to practice in the state in which they practice. And what CMS has done is they've made an exception for medical residents, and they did that. And they're not requiring reporting of payments to medical residents. And it seems to me like it's largely an administrative reason. They said it was going to be difficult for us to accurately identify residents, ensure that payments or other transfers of value are attributed to them because they do not have, quote, an NPI and or state professional license number. And they acknowledge that some residents are actually able to license to practice medicine in some states and not other states. They don't mention or describe whether residents kind of overall are authorized to make prescribing decisions, et cetera. So, you know, I think this is kind of a weakness in the rulemaking, and I think it's something that I think we'd like to kind of discuss whether we have any options to try to challenge this in some way. It seems to me like they're making the decision based on their difficulty tracking the data or information based on the, you know, absence or presence of a NPI number. And I've heard from some folks that CMS may have gotten that wrong, that, you know, that all residents have an NPI number. So, you know, I'm hoping this is not just an error of some kind. In terms of how this relates to teaching hospitals, you know, payments to teaching hospitals will have to be disclosed, or have to be reported and disclosed. It seems to me like if industry makes a big payment to a teaching hospital and then that money is then used for, you know, various fellowships, et cetera, those payments to, you know, fellows who are residents wouldn't have to be reported under the resident's name if the manufacturer didn't know their name to begin with, and under this exception, they wouldn't have to report them, perhaps even if they did know the name, but they'd still have to report the payment if it was made to a teaching hospital.
And I have one more here so far. How will the availability of the information be promoted, and do you think patients will take the time to look up their doctors?
So CMS actually went to some length to describe how they're going to, first of all, let physicians know when the information is available for the review. They're going to get different email lists and distribute it through those, and also through teaching hospitals, et cetera. I think that the information is going to be kind of publicly disclosed on a CMS website. And I think there's going to be a lot of public interest in it, just like we saw in the kind of ProPublica database that was launched about a year and a half or 2 years ago. So I think that that's actually in part going to be a job for, us as consumer advocates to publicize the existence of this information. Now, how patients or the public will use this information, I think, is a real question. I mean, personally, I think that as we saw with ProPublica, you're probably going to see an increased amount of public scrutiny, certainly by reporters, and researchers, about the relationships that physicians who receive industry kind of money and other transfers of value, when those physicians do other things like sit on an FDA review committee deciding about the approval of new drugs, for instance, or physicians who may sit on a pharmacy and therapeutics committee for any public entity that is required to, publicly release the names of the people who are making those decisions. I think you're going to see a lot more scrutiny by reporters and, potentially advocates and others. In terms of actual consumers using this information, we haven't really looked at any, haven't had access to any studies about how ProPublica is being used. We only have kind of anecdotal stories, but I've heard a number of them that consumers are looking up whether their physicians have these relationships or not. One problem with ProPublica is that it's not as comprehensive as the Physician Payment Sunshine Act will be, so it can be frustrating for patients to look up their doctor and not be sure whether the database they're looking at is comprehensive and complete or not. So,
well, could you explain what ProPublica is in case we have some folks on the call who don't know?
Sure. So if you Google dollars for docs, D-O-C-S, you'll find a public website that was created by this nonprofit organization called ProPublica. And what they did is they pulled together all the available public information about industry payments to physicians from the different Department of Justice required disclosures and the number of states that have also required transparency and disclosure. So they put it all into one combined database, and you could put in a doctor's name and the state, and look and see if there are any records of that physician receiving payments from any of these industries that have had to report thus far. So it's been a useful resource, I know, for some reporters and others who've been checking on whether people commenting in the public domain and in the press have relationships or not. So I think we're probably going to see the same kind of uses of it. One thing I did see about a year and a half ago was a study that was done looking at how patients responded when, in the examination room, when they're meeting with their doctor face-to-face, their doctor makes a disclosure and says something like, I just want you to know that I receive, $30,000 or $50,000 a year from, Pfizer. I'm a consultant with them, et cetera. And the result of this study actually was kind of surprising because to me at first, because they found that when patients hear that, instead of reacting skeptically about the care or the advice their physician is giving them, they actually react the opposite way. It actually makes them, in a way, to be more trusting of their physician. And when I first heard it, I was a little skeptical of the results, etc., but you know, then I thought about it more, and I kind of understood that in that particular environment, it's a very trusting doctor-patient environment. And so I can understand the patient reacting that way, you know, at the moment. You know whether patients will continue to be as non-skeptical if they're seeing evidence that their physician is receiving lots and lots of money and there's a correlation to products that they might be, you know, prescribed. Well, I think over time we're going to see whether this changes the way patients look at the care they're getting.
Let me just repeat Ann's email one more time for more questions. ann.wolloson@npalliance.net. Ann, do you have some more there for us?
I have one sort of as a follow-up to the ProPublica information. Given that ProPublica's dollars for docs has been around for a while, can we predict these disclosures change physician or company behaviors?
Well, yeah, I will say, you know, one thing I heard a while ago, but a year ago or so, speaking to someone with a Blue Cross Blue Shield here in the New England area, was that when this physician payment sunshine kind of rule was imminent, and you know, doctors thought it could come out at any moment, you know, this person said that they were seeing that this was having a chilling effect, that physicians were basically saying to, you know, drug industry representatives, you know, don't drop off that lunch. I don't want to have to see it on a public website and have to explain it to my patients, et cetera. So, you know, I heard anecdotally that there was some chilling effect going on then. You know, I'm not aware that if anybody studied whether ProPublica has had a chilling effect on the practices by physicians per se. But, you know, the one problem with ProPublica is it only covers, I think, about between, you know, 15 to maybe 20% of all the drug manufacturers and their estimated payments. So it's not as comprehensive as we would like.
So, Wells, when a drug company is fined, is this going to be posted somewhere for people to see when they fine for violating the act?
That's a good question. I believe that is supposed to be public as well. And I believe there'll be an annual report to Congress by CMS on the status of the program overall, and I think it'll include a reporting of violations and enforcement action.
Okay. And we have some more questions?
I don't have any other questions at the moment. I do want to mention, Wells and I were talking about this earlier today. In Maine, we have somebody who sits on our drug utilization review board, who is probably one of the highest paid docs on the ProPublica website, or was. That information kind of came out about 2 years ago, and he no longer, or at least he says he no longer, takes funding from the drug companies, which I thought was kind of interesting. Now, since then, he's been hired by the state's PBM to advise on certain prescription drug issues, so he's kind of found another way to supplement his income. But when that information did come out...
it did change his behavior.
Yes.
Apparently, yeah. You know, so I'd be curious, you know, if there's some physicians out there who want to kind of share some thoughts or ideas. I'd be curious, you know, what they're hearing about the Physician Pain Sunshine Act, if they're hearing anything about it at all. You know, there are deadlines coming up as of August 1 of this year. You know, their colleagues might start talking about it, and, you know, September of 2014 will be the first disclosures for, you know, the months of August through December of this year. So I'd be curious if people are talking about it, or if doctors or med students want to kind of speculate about how they would use the information. You know, like if a medical student would be inclined to look up you know, a physician who was giving a guest lecture at their medical school or something like that. I mean, that seems like an obvious use, but I'd be curious if they have other ideas that they're thinking about this.
And we welcome comments from anyone on the call. If you've muted your line, just hit *6 to unmute. Just announce your name and where you're from and let us know what you think. Any volunteers? I guess not. Not yet, huh? Anybody?
Hi.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi, this is Reshma from the American Medical Student Association. Interestingly enough, I had a conversation today with a dean of a medical school talking about how their conflict of interest policies have changed. And one of the things he actually brought up on his own was the impact of the Physician Payment Sunshine Act on their own reporting system that they have at the school. They have a public website right now which documents all their faculty payments. And their complaints office is actually thinking of figuring out a way to cross-check the payments that are reported to them annually with the database that's coming from the Sunshine Act. So they're actually going to keep that public website up, but they're going to use it, use the Sunshine Act website as a way to check up on faculty and see if they're disclosing all their payments.
All right. Did I hear somebody else get ready to say something? Anybody else hearing about the Sunshine Act with, from your colleagues or in your institution?
So, other than I mentioned, my name is Mark Ryan. I'm a family doc here in Richmond. I haven't actually heard any real murmurings about it. I work in an academic health center, and I certainly haven't heard any great concern, but I also work in a department that doesn't have maybe as many direct ties to the company, but I haven't seen any real communication from internal stuff, from faculty affairs, anything like that. So I'm wondering if folks are really registering it yet or if it's still being processed up at the higher levels of the institution before giving any sort of heads up, or if we're just going to be sort of left on our own to figure it out. I also work with one of our specialty organizations, and we do a lot of CME planning and such, and I haven't heard it come up there either. So I'm wondering if there are a number of docs or organizations that have been kind of watching this but still haven't really made a position or a statement specifically as to where they're going to land in terms of what comes next.
Hmm. Well, you know, Mark, the rule is only like 26, 27 days old, and you know, it's a 260-page rule, 280-page rule, double space. So you know, there's a lot of detail in there. So it could be that institutions are, you know, like us, still kind of working through what all the implications are from this rule. So that could be why. CMS has said that they're going to create a process for physicians to actually register with CMS ahead of time so that they could be given the kind of key information so they can look up the disclosures related to them, whether there are any or not, et cetera. So I think at a certain point, the CMS will be reaching out to physicians, but they have a bit of time to work through all of that.
Okay. Anybody else?
But, you know, I do think at a certain point, you know, institutions should certainly let physicians know that starting on August 1st, all sorts of interactions with the industry that involve any payment or meal or any other transfer of value, all those things are going to end up becoming public. So, you know, physicians, I think, have to be aware of that fact and think about what the potential consequences could be.
Maybe the lawyers are still reviewing it.
I'll just add one thing. This is Marcia, that I actually sit as a consumer representative on a committee at a teaching hospital that reviews some payments, industry payments, and I think it, because it's in Massachusetts, we've had a similar law in Massachusetts for a number of years, and so there's a high level of awareness when the committee is thinking about their particular policies about this, what will be actually become public on the Massachusetts website, and so they're sensitive to that and want their faculty to understand what may become public. So I imagine that that will be a dynamic nationally once this is up.
Okay, any other questions or comments for Wells, what people are hearing? You got anything else there that anyone's emailed you, Ann?
I don't.
Well, maybe we should wind up the call now unless we have any other late-breaking questions or Wells or Marcia, if you have something else you'd like to share with folks.
Well, you know, one thing that I think is going to be a challenge for consumer advocate groups and also groups like NPA that work with physicians is trying to kind of educate the public about what the real meaning and the implications of these different transactions are to the public, because we don't want kind of overreaction in kind of negative ways, and we also certainly don't want industry to try to gloss over everything and try to represent every possible financial transaction as being, you know, appropriate, et cetera. So I think it's going to be create a public education challenge that we're going to have to, you know, figure out, and it's going to be a challenge for patients and for physicians as well, I think.
Yep.
I think one of the things that we've thought about, too, as far as the use of this by individual patients, there may be ways that organizations like ours and others could help to educate patients and have them be looking at some of this data as groups, because often, you know, it's difficult to raise these issues with the individual physician, but if you're able to discuss the implications and think about it in a together, then it's easier to use the information. So that there may be some possibilities in that way.
All right.
Rachel, before we sign off with folks, this is Anna Wollison again, and I just want to mention to people, well, first of all, thank you very much, Rachel. Thank you, Wells, and thank you, Marcia, for giving us this important update on these rules, and I'm guessing and sure that there will be questions down the road on this, and look forward to talking with you and working with you on providing further clarification down the road. I want to mention just again another plug to NPA's unbranded doctor website, where some of these resources, National Grand Round, and these calls are archived. In particular, tomorrow, the link to our last National Grand Round featuring Dr. Howard Brody, who is the director of the at the Institute of Medical Humanities at the University of Texas, spoke and gave an update on the status of the problem of conflict of interest in medicine that was hosted at the University of Texas in Houston on February 8th. And again, that link will be put up on NPA's website tomorrow, and I would urge you to listen to it. He gave a really great talk on what's going on with that issue and some of the initiatives, ongoing initiatives to try to reduce conflicts of interest. And I'll stop there. And again, thank you very much, Rachel.
And thank you, everybody. And I think our next call will be in approximately 2 months. Watch your email for the date and information. We do post the recordings and written notes from these calls at npalliance.org/conflict-free. So we welcome folks accessing there. Thank you all for joining us tonight, Wells and Marcia, particularly. Thank you. And
sure.
We'll speak with everybody again, we hope, in another couple months.
Great.
Have a good evening, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.